Welcome to the Minerals and Royalties Podcast, the home of CEOs and investors in the minerals and royalties space.
Hey guys, this is Tim Powell from the Minerals and Royalties Authority. I recently sat down with Will Harris, Managing Director of DV Trading's new OTC hedging business. During the episode, Will talks through some of the different geopolitical and market factors that are affecting natural gas and crude pricing. He also breaks down all the factors that come into play that should be considered by minerals and non-op companies when they look to implement a hedging program. Let's jump into the episode and hear more of what Will had to say.
All right, Will, good afternoon. Happy New Year and welcome onto the podcast.
Hey, Tim. Happy New Year to you. Great to talk to you, man.
No, it's been good to reconnect. You know, funny story about ARM. I joined Energy Council in 2014 and my first client ever was ARM, and it was to help y'all enter the Canadian market. So got to know Zach and then you in due course and Keith Barnett and, you know, all the folks, you know, from the ARM alumni base, if you may, over the years. And then as you guys got more and more out of the hedging advisory business and more into the physical side, just didn't really have a means of working directly as much, but still we'd see each other at events and things of that nature, always kept in touch. And now you have a new hat on at DV Trading and you're doing some stuff in the minerals and auto space. So it's been glad to kind of close that loop and reconnect. So please, little background yourself and, you know, you're coming from kind of finance, commodities trading background, just paint the picture for everyone. And then, you know, kind of the evolution of your career and how you've ended up here. And then we'll go into DV Trading, what they do and their offering, and we'll take it from there.
Perfect. Yeah, Tim, well, it's great to reconnect as well. I mean, I remember us banging around Midland. This has got to be like 5 or 6, 7 years ago. It seems like forever ago. But when you were organizing events out there, they were always very well attended. But yeah, you know, I grew up, born in New York, grew up some on the East Coast, some on the West Coast, went to University of Virginia, then did an MBA at Stern NYU. And right after that, joined Credit Suisse Financial Products, which was the kind of where I started my career in derivatives. That was back in the sort of the early days of derivatives. And it was still a unified product versus kind of being spread out amongst the different underlying commodities and products. And it was, it was kind of wild west in derivatives era back then. You know, we would do these gold, you know, 5-year gold knockout swaps and just things that really don't get done anymore. But it was a great time to learn the business. And then I moved from Credit Suisse to Merrill in 2010, moved down to Houston, spent about 8 or 9 years living in Houston, had a great time living there and got to know a lot of people there. And I still go there all the time. And then moved to Deutsche for a few years before they closed down their commodities business. Always in the role that I always had was basically managing the sales teams, you know, with trading primarily energy, but also other commodities like metals and ags and a few other things. But, you know, energy has always been the focus and it's always been the biggest single piece of the business. And I'd say producers have always been the largest part of the energy portfolio as well. So that's been, you know, ever since Credit Suisse days, I've always been talking to producers and, you know, all throughout the country and internationally. You know, Credit Suisse, when you're working in the banks, it's always focused on the really big ones, you know, like the Chesapeakes and the Pioneers and the, you know, large, really large cap companies. And then when I left Deutsche, I moved to ARM, as you mentioned, which was a hedge advisor and also moved into midstream and gas marketing. So it was good to kind of spread out and spread my wings and do a few other things other than, you know, just financial derivatives. But there was a much smaller profile of the company. Those were, you know, ARM focused on kind of the mid cap, small cap, private, a lot of private names, a lot of private equity backed companies. And so, you know, spent a good 6-7 years there, and then ARM kind of wound down that hedging business. And so I teamed up with DV Trading, which was trying to get into the business, and, you know, here we are now.
Awesome. Well, I wasn't familiar with DV Trading when you reached out to me. Fairly prominent name in the market making space, right? And defining what a market maker is as well would be helpful for a lot of folks listening. Just get a little background on DV Trading, their positioning in the market and what they've done historically and then what you're doing. I'll just say this as a preface, just giving your background with ARM, you're not doing hedge advisor anymore. You're actually physically involved in the trade. So I just want to say that as a disclaimer up front, because, you know, I've spoken to some folks and opened some doors for you recently and folks are like, oh, no, we use Aegis. We don't use ARM anymore or any competitor. I'm like, no, it's Will's not doing the same thing at ARM, right? So just wanted to say that, but over to you, DV Trading, break it down.
Yeah, and you know, I think, you know, DV Trading is a big trading firm and have to make that disclaimer that my opinions and views are my views and not the views of DV Trading, just to make sure that compliance disclaimer is made. But yeah, so DV Trading is a principal, will be a principal to any hedges that we do. We're not an advisor, very similar to the other dealers. And I know you've had some of the other, you know, banks and dealers on your podcast. But yes, we will be the principal to the hedge. And really, DV comes at it from a little bit of a different angle than I'd say the banks and some of the either producer dealers or, you know, trading houses that have built out a hedging business as part of their physical business. We don't have a physical business. We are primarily market makers, which really means the ultimate source of liquidity in the market, which is the risk, the actual trades that go through the exchanges. Typically, a dealer will come to a market maker like ourselves, and we will basically absorb that risk and then manage it through a various different types of exchanges and different ways and technologies that they, you know, to handle the delta and the risk that goes through the market. So it's a very high tech business. It's a very focused, you know, the DV's built up multiple different platforms all around the world where they manage this risk second to second. It's really, you know, based on algorithms and kind of high tech platforms where they can take a big, huge, chunky position and then divide it up and manage it, you know, in seconds to basically, you know, execute where you know, whatever the broker or the dealer that's coming to them wants to offload that risk. So, you know, but they're always trading, you know, DV is traditionally traded through the screen, traded on exchange, everything is cleared. You know, it's an international, very fast moving business, but typically, you know, you aren't really, DV isn't really connected to the source of that risk. It's not, you know, over, you know, traditionally, you know, DV's been around 15 years or so, and they haven't set up where they can trade directly with a producer or a consumer. And so now, you know, given that we have, you know, over 300 traders worldwide, you know, between Chicago, New York, London, Singapore, Dubai, et cetera, it's a natural extension of that market making business to basically build an OTC platform that you can now trade directly with. So that's my role. And that's what that's, you know, I've known them for a while and they've always been interested in getting into that business. And then the opportunity arose after I left ARM. So, you know, it's a very interesting company. It's private. It doesn't have, you know, a huge public presence like, you know, a lot of the other dealers who may have, you know, may be in the oil and gas producing business. They may have, you know, big physical businesses. And I think that's one of the attractions that I've had moving to DV. It's a very focused business plan here. You know, we're not like a bank trying to go out and, you know, do an RBL or do an IPO or do an M&A deal. We don't have that sort of ancillary. So our clients don't need to be companies that do that, right? Similar to some of the dealers who want to basically, you know, own that physical molecule. We do not have a physical business. So we then, again, it's not part of our business to try to do hedges to build the marketing business. So it's very focused. We're purely in it for, you know, to basically build a portfolio of hedging counterparties and, you know, that then feeds into our huge network of market making traders, right? So we have the liquidity, we have all the products already trading every single day. And now we're just sort of extending that into kind of like the real world, if you can think about that way.
Welcome to An Ounce of Prevention. The team at Our Recent Associates has partnered with Tim Powell to bring you brief legal updates on issues that matter to mineral owners, non-ops, and operators. We hope you find this segment informative. As always, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me, Rachel Reese, at rreese@rreeselaw.com. Today we are talking about a case out of the Oklahoma Supreme Court called Tracy versus Raker Resources. In this case, Trey C sued to cancel a lease based on cessation of production so that JNR Energy could enforce its top lease. The facts of this case are a bit convoluted, so instead we are going to focus on the court's analysis. What you need to know from the facts is this. The parties are arguing about whether the Cohen well, which was operated by Raker Resources and was holding the Cohen lease, had ceased producing such that the Cohen lease expired. And when we say ceased producing, what we are really talking about is ceased producing in paying quantities. The Oklahoma Supreme Court did a great job in this case, explaining the difference between the amount of time that should be reviewed under a habendum clause to determine if production has ceased, and the time period prescribed in a cessation of production clause that an operator has to resume operations after production has ceased. To catch anyone up who needs it, a habendum clause is the clause in the lease that tells you how long the lease is in force. It usually says something like, for a period of 3 years, the primary term, and for so long thereafter as oil or gas is produced in paying quantities from the lease. The cessation of production clause that Trey C relied on reads like this. If, after the expiration of the primary term of this lease, production on the lease premises shall cease for any cause, this lease shall not terminate, provided lessee resumes operations for drilling a well within 60 days from such cessation. Raker argued that the habendum clause and the cessation of production clause work separately, and before the 60-day period of the cessation of production clause kicks in, you first have to show that production has ceased. Trey C, on the other hand, contended that the 60-day period in the cessation of production clause actually narrows the amount of time that would be used in the habendum clause to determine cessation, down to 60 days. The Oklahoma Supreme Court disagreed with Trey C. The purpose of a cessation of production clause, according to the court, is to establish a grace period for after cessation has occurred. Since it only comes into play after cessation, it doesn't have any bearing on whether cessation has occurred. The court went on to discuss what is an appropriate review period for production in paying quantities. Citing good old Clifton v. Kuntz, the court reiterated that it's a reasonable amount of time under the circumstances. And when you look at the circumstances, you consider all matters that would influence a reasonably prudent operator. They went on to look at the facts of this case and held that even if all the evidence presented by Trey C, which sought to establish loss of profitability for 3 months, was correct, 3 months was way too short of a review period as a matter of law to establish cessation. We are discussing this case today to highlight the fact that your cessation of production clause may not mean what you think it means. People often get confused about this. When you read these clauses on their face, it may seem reasonable to think that it says that if a well goes down, the lease expires in 60 days, or whatever amount of time is stated in your clause. But case law, not just in Oklahoma, tells us that to figure out when production ceases, you look at the habendum clause. Once production ceases, then you look at the cessation of production clause to determine what to do next. I hope this was helpful. As always, if you want to learn more about this or other cases that may affect you and your company, subscribe to our blog, An Ounce of Prevention, or follow our recent associates on LinkedIn for the latest updates.
The information and material in this advertisement is general information about our practice and firm and is for educational and informational purposes only. This information does not offer specific legal advice, and the use of this information does not create an attorney-client relationship with our RNA or any of its attorneys. The information in this advertisement should not be considered legal advice, and persons should not act upon this information without first engaging professional legal counsel.
Yes. So the by nature, you know, the minerals and nanos space is comprised of small to mid-cap size companies. And you've told me in the past, DV's platform caters to that size company very well. Why is that? You mentioned being private, you know, expand upon it a little bit further. But, you know, so someone's listening and they actively hedge or they're looking to hedge and they're looking to build a book of counterparties. What do you bring to the table that is attractive for them as they go through that process?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, when we were approaching, you know, kind of building this model and kind of writing the business plan on this, you know, last year, the larger cap companies and the public companies and the companies with, you know, I don't know, 10,000 barrels a day equivalent and larger, they have plenty of counterparties, right? They've got usually either a pretty robust banking group, or even if they're, you know, more mid-sized, they've got, you know, they may have one of the physical dealers or several of the physical dealers already kind of competing for that business. And you know, I think the smaller end of the producer spectrum is where there's really like need for someone like us to come in. I think that's first and foremost. So second, I think our, you know, we are, again, we're private. We have, you know, we're a pretty big company, big balance sheet, et cetera, but we're definitely not looking to try to, you know, do the largest and the largest volume and the longest tenor trades out there, right? We'll leave that to some of the bigger guys or the big money center banks or some of the large traders. You know, the other thing is we really like the, you know, we're not only, you know, a trading company, but we're also an investor, right? So we actually have, we have a fund where we've invested in companies that are typically, you know, we have an energy allocation and it goes to kind of non-op or very sort of smaller scale, conventional, low risks kind of PDP type of investments. And that's something that our principals have really liked over the years. So I think we look at it as like holistically in that it fits our, it sort of fits our profile of client where we think we can compete well. We also just like this, right? It's fairly conservative, but it really matches up with kind of our philosophy in this business and that, you know, these companies are, you know, fairly conservatively managed from a balance sheet perspective. They're, you know, the returns on their capital is good. We think they're going to be around for a while and we can grow with these types of companies. So, you know, I'll just add one other thing that we're trying to be, you know, as a relatively new entrant, we're also, I think, a little bit more entrepreneurial and a little bit more flexible on things like documents and credit and timelines that sometimes, you know, some of the smaller companies that you, you know, in the minerals and non-op space, you know, can get a little bit stuck in the bureaucracy of the much larger companies who have, you know, again, who are not only trying to put an ISDA in place with a smaller scale non-op company, but have, you know, five large publicly traded independent companies that are also, you know, negotiating ISDAs and pulling a lot of their time, which we are not really pursuing at this point. So, you know, so that's I think it just fits our general scale and strategy. And then I think we, you know, like to look at this a little bit more as a merchant in the sense of like, we're kind of investing credit when we, you know, when we sign up an ISDA with Line, and we like to, you know, be very confident that they're going to do well. And, you know, and every once in a while we'll invest alongside them.
For those listening, can you kind of walk through characteristics of companies that are a pretty good fit for your platform? So size, let's talk kind of production ranges, maybe. I know there's no hard and fast rules around this stuff, but just a guidance. If I'm listening here, what you're saying is interesting. I'm looking at hedging or a hedger ready, and you go, oh, wait, all the things he said, that sounds like my company. Maybe I should give it a go, right? It's kind of the punchline here. So size, you know, if you work with a bank, the hedging capabilities associated with that, is it in place, not in place, so on and so forth. Just run down some of the criteria that could be attractive, make DV attractive if you're a company that has these things.
Sure. I mean, I think in a general, you know, general rule, you know, most of the companies that we're going to look at are going to be, as I said, well south of 10,000 BOE a day type flowing production. And probably the sweet spot is going to be lower than 5,000. Just
what's the minimum?
And then we don't really have a minimum. I mean, we've done very, very small trades with folks who are literally doing, you know, several thousand barrels a month type of thing, right? So those are not, we don't really have a floor. I think, but kind of going back to the initial comment, like a lot of the companies we've been successful are like in fund number two or fund number three, just bought some new assets and maybe don't have a lot of flowing production yet, but have some capital they want to deploy. They need to get some hedges on the books. And we're happy to do their first few deals, right? Their first few assets, their first few wells, because we understand that they've got, you know, they're looking at deals all the time and they're going to, you know, in the next 12 months, they're going to double or triple in size. So the, you know, that's, we look at it kind of, can we grow with people? You know, if they're really small, we're going to do our best. They've got to sort of hit a very minimum threshold just to be, get through compliance and be able to trade a derivative, right? There's a few kind of basic Dodd requirements, but those are most people can hit that, right? It's like a few million bucks of capital, right? You can do a trade, right? But the main point for us is if it's going to be a company that we think is going to grow and you know, we'll want to do more trading as we, you know, as things develop. So, you know, so I think we're probably much more open for the smaller companies. You know, these companies are just, that are literally hundreds of barrels a day of production that want to get started. And then, you know, we've told a few folks like, look, you've got some small volumes today, and maybe in 2 months or 3 months, you think you're going to add some significant volume, may as well get set up right now, even if you're not going to hedge your small volumes. So when you're ready to go, and you know, either your wells start producing or you've added some more assets, you know, now you can pull the trigger if both your volumes and the markets coincide to be good, you know, good opportunities. So basically that's, you know, that's kind of our current strategy. And, you know, I think we've had pretty good luck so far of getting some companies onboarded and docked up that, you know, I think in other places I work would have been a lot more difficult.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors.
Looking to ramp up deal flow for your minerals and non-op ground game? Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has closed on over 120 deals, totaling $110 million in value, with deal sizes ranging from $50K upwards of $5 million. Whether you're looking for white space, permit, duck, PDP, AFE, or wellbore-only deals, the Texas Mineral Company has got you covered. For more information on how to source deal flow from the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information. Farmers National Company has oil and gas experts located across the country ready to provide you unmatched convenience and service for your land management needs. Whether you're looking for turnkey management of oil and gas interests, or simply looking for an advisor to help you sell or lease your minerals, Farmers National Company has you covered. Learn more about Farmers National Company's team of certified mineral managers, landmen, attorneys, and accountants by going to fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com. Does your team ever struggle with employee turnover? What about right-sizing your team to fit your company's needs over time? Do you have the right accounting systems and software in place to maintain control and visibility on all your cost centers? If any of these things are challenges in your business, then Opportune's back office outsourcing could be the right solution. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com.
So, Will, for those listening who don't hedge or aren't really that educated on how hedging programs work, break down, I know it's basic, but break down what an ISDA is, why it's needed, kind of the process of getting an ISDA, what the timeline could be. If, you know, I'm thinking about hedging, is this a 12-month process, a 6-month process? And then DV has an in-house legal team, right, that can help with this, which is, again, I think one of the things where you're reporting that our platform caters to small, mid-sized companies because it's kind of like, you know, getting the training wheels on and getting you started. So over to you.
Yeah, I mean, the ISDA, you know, it's a International Swap Dealers Association piece of paper, which is like this 150-page master document that basically governs every type of, you know, eventuality in the market, from like bombs going off to exchanges getting frozen to people going bankrupt to, you know, cats and dogs flying out of the sky. Basically, it's like the most laborious piece of paper to ever read. But anyway, it's necessary to be it basically replicates the process of trading through an exchange, but through a bilateral contract, right? So all the covers everything that could ever happen in any type of transaction. And then you have to negotiate what's called a schedule, which is basically a few terms within that master agreement that are particularly relevant to what you're doing, whether you're trading oil and gas, what type of company you are. You know, and the people are always like trying to tweak different bits of the document, and so it sort of evolves over time. But nevertheless, it's a reality. I've been dealing with them for 25 years basically, and they're just a, you know, it's a necessary piece of paper to get in place to trade. We try to make it very, very easy. We have a very boilerplate schedule which we use as our sort of framework to start. And then it's really adapted from kind of market standards of other of documents that have been put in place by a lot of the other banks and dealers over the years, and really just trying to distill it down to make it as easy as possible and really only focusing on things that are very, very, you know, important. For example, if you have some type of collateral arrangements or if you have a security arrangement where you get gain access to the underlying reserves through what's called an intercreditor agreement, or if you have other types of credit terms, it really does affect your the credit profile of the company. Those are the main things. Everything else is more or less standardized, right? So we have a draft. We can do all the work. It really comes down to, you know, we also are very happy to use the ISDA that any client has already negotiated and has already gotten their own counsel comfortable with. We will happily look at that. And again, we do have a team of lawyers in-house because we have other OTC businesses beyond the energy within DV Trading. So it's just a matter of days of turning it around. And again, we try to be pretty lean and mean and nimble, you know, given that we're, you know, a little smaller and B, a little newer than some of the other guys out there. So as long as you know, we can get it done in a matter of days, you know, if the counterparty, you know, is basically comfortable with all draft, or we're happy to review whatever paper they're putting in place. So once you get that done, it basically, you tick the box, you've got paper in place, you've got the KYC, the know your client stuff done, that basically you have to do for Dodd-Frank perspective. You know, who owns the company? Are they of a certain scale? Who are the authorized traders? Just really basic stuff like that. And then as soon as you get that done, you're ready to go. Like, you can quote anything, you know, with whatever you want to trade. You can call me up. You can email me. We use ICE. We use whatever form of communication. We also use some of the, you know, the commodity advisors like Aegis. We use them, their platforms for clients that they're working with. We're basically agnostic to how we get trades done, and you're ready to go, right? So that's, we try to keep it as basic and simple as possible. We don't have, you know, since we're not a bank or a you know, international dealer, you know, our ISDAs don't reflect a lot of sort of internal requirements that some of these other houses have that make them a little bit more complicated than if it's just, you know, a US-based company trading with another US-based company. So, you know, it's a pain, but I've literally done hundreds and hundreds of ISDAs over the years. So, you know the pain points, know how to get them done pretty quickly. And that's kind of one of the main focus right now.
So if I'm a company right now and I have a hedging program and I use BP or I use EDF or I use Shell or I use Vitol or Cargill, one or multiple of those companies and other counterparties out there, like, why would I want to consider an additional counterparty like DV? Like, this is the one question I asked you when we first connected, right? Like, I don't know how it works. This is not my side of the business, but is it kind of like, well, DV, you're too late. This sounds really great. I wish we talked 12 months ago, but now I'm already locked in with somebody. And you said, no, that's not necessarily the case. And the credit arrangement was a big aspect you said is a big benefit. There's also just the ability to give increased optionality to folks. So can you really unpack that a little bit? And why bringing you guys in as an alternative counterparty, there's all sorts of positives around that, even if you're working with some others already.
Sure. I mean, it's a great question. It's always good to have several options, right? You know, two is better than one, three is better than two, four is better than three. Maybe you don't need six, right? But having a handful for a variety, I think the main two reasons is you want to have multiple dealers in your hedge group is, first of all, you want to make sure you have price transparency, right? And the only real way you get price transparency is to compare, right? And the second reason is, I would say, you know, there's a huge life cycle in trades and companies, right? And there's also a life cycle in dealers. And sometimes, you know, a company's done a lot of business with one dealer, markets move, credit capacities can change. And so even, you know, one year, someone could be the most aggressive, and the next year, you know, something happens in the world and they have to really ramp back their lines. And so you just always want to have alternatives. I'd say from pricing perspective, you know, we should be in the market with all the other dealers, right? The sort of capital charges are fairly, you know, are relatively consistent. They move around, you know, with interest rates and general market moves a little bit, but it's you know, the market is what it is. But we have the liquidity where we're trading those products every single day. So we should be pretty sharp on our ultimate, the ultimate risk management side of it, which is, you know, the price that you get as a producer is really composed of two things. It's the market price that's traded over the, over on exchange or on cleared markets, which is basically the bid offer. If say DV is trading with Goldman Sachs, right? That is where the market is. And those markets are, you know, very efficient, and they are a, and they do move around, and there's liquidity issues, and there's, you know, the whole, you know, sometimes there's less liquidity and sometimes there's more liquidity, but that's the ultimate price that the, that any dealer sees as their sort of base price when they're making a, you know, when they're making a market to a counterparty. And then there's the credit and capital charges that basically someone, any dealer needs to add to basically compensate them for extending credit and doing all the sort of is base paperwork and bilateral trade management, right? And that's, that can be, that certainly can vary between dealer to dealer. But again, you want to have the most, you want to have options, you want to have the competitive, you want to have that competitive when you're out there doing your volumes.
Can you, this is going to make me sound a little uneducated and stupid, but can you really discuss and break down what it means for your credit capacity to go, you know, more aggressive and a little more bearish, and how that all fits in, and just really how the credit is set up? You know, you mentioned intercreditor agreement, or, you know, having collateral and assets directly. I mean, very simply put, you know, I'm not in your world. If I'm a producer or a minerals company or whatever, and I want to lock in a hedge at $80 for the next 3 years,
yeah,
oil production, that very simply, that's just what I think about. So how does, what do you mean by credit capacity, and why is that fluctuating? Just explain that all. I, you know, I'm not afraid to go on a mic and say stupid things and questions, but I know others are listening that are in the same boat as me. So even if it's only one or two, I'm hoping to bring some value to them. If you can explain it.
Sure. I mean, it's, you know, the trading world is a little esoteric, right? So it's a very good question. I think the, you know, the alternative, what if you're a producer or you're anyone, right? You have two alternatives of managing your commodity risk. You can open up a clearing account with the exchange and literally trade on the exchange with the CME or the NYMEX or whatever product you want to do. And you, you know, you go through brokers who can source those deals for you. And then you basically have to then collateralize those trades from day one, right? Which means you have to put up initial margin, call it 5% of the value of the notional trade. And then every single day, if the market moves for against you or for you, the exchange calls cash, you know, in from your account. And basically you true up the value of that every single day. So that doesn't make a ton of sense for producers to do. A, it's very logistically, it takes a lot of managing, you know, because you've got to be moving cash every single day. And secondly, you know, producers are putting most of their money into the drill bit or investing in assets. They're not trying to leave a ton of liquidity out there to manage trading positions, right? Because, you know, you've got a lot better use for your capital than sitting in a money market account waiting to be called by, you know, your dealer, your clearing broker. So, you know, you're going to put in place a lot of, you know, say a lot of the smaller mid-sized producers have traditionally, you know, traded through OTC, through an ISDA with a, you know, with a credit line that doesn't cause you to post either initial or variation margin over the life of that deal. So all you do is settle it out when it expires, right? And so that's the way that, you know, most EMPs or non-ops or any type of you know, oil and gas producer is typically setting up their business. And it really makes sense, right? That's, you want to be focusing on drilling wells, buying assets, or, you know, or all the other things that you can use your capital on rather than trading, you know, trading with the exchange. So you basically, you put on a trade with someone like us, and we evaluate your basic, the ability to manage those hedges over time. And, but again, the dealer is effectively lending the client, the counterparty, the money to basically support those deals over the life of that trade. And so that's where sort of that capital credit charge comes in.
And then you guys having the liquidity on a daily basis and the balance sheet are settling those trades on an ongoing basis, correct?
Yeah. So we have that position on the other side with some type of exchange or with futures. Or, you know, there's multiple ways of sort of offloading our risk, you know, as a market maker. But ultimately, you know, if you put on a hedge at 70 and the market goes to 80, someone is going to be asking us for 10 bucks a barrel, and we're not asking the producer for 10 bucks a barrel. We'll ask for that 10 bucks if it expires, if the hedge expires, $10 out of the money, obviously the producer is going to write that check. But every single day, that mark-to-market position is not called. So that's kind of the genius of OTC trading, right? You can do whatever you want on your bilateral limits, right? I can take your reserves as collateral to get my credit comfortable. I can take cash. I can take chickens, right? It's whatever I want, right? I mean, you can put any type of collateral arrangements in there that your institution is comfortable with.
Hey guys, I wanted to take a quick break from the conversation to say thank you to all of our podcast sponsors. Your property is your legacy, so you should only leave it in the hands of a land management company who has a legacy of its own. If you own oil and gas interests or act as a fiduciary for those who do, you can find a long-term partner at Farmers National Company, who since 1929 has taken great pride in helping clients maximize the benefits of property ownership by providing turnkey management services and by working alongside them through generational transfers of specialized assets such as oil and gas interests and farmland. To learn more, visit fncenergy.com or reach out directly at energy@farmersnational.com.
Since 2019, the Texas Mineral Company has been a leading ground game broker for minerals and non-op deals, closing over 120 transactions across the Permian, SCOOP/STACK, Haynesville, Bakken, Powder River Basin, DJ, and Eagleford. With deal sizes ranging from 50K upwards of 5 million and 1.5 NRAs upwards of 3,500 NRAs, the Texas Mineral Company can be flexible on where and how they can source your deal flow. For more information on how your team can work with the Texas Mineral Company, please email Toby Martinez at toby@thetexasmineralcompany.com.
Scaling up your portfolio while minimizing G&A is the name of the game in the minerals and non-op space. Whether you're a brand new fund, an established team who's growing quickly, or a fully developed portfolio in harvest mode, Opportune's back office outsourcing team can help. Stop worrying about all the headaches that come along with day-to-day accounting and back office operations and contact Opportune today. For more information, please visit www.opportune.com. Over the past 20 years, Riverbend Energy Group has been the definitive leader in the non-op and mineral space, where they are actively acquiring minerals in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, the Williston, and the Eagleford. Following their $1.8 billion sale of their non-op platform in 2022, they are also back actively acquiring non-op interests in the Delaware Basin, Midland Basin, and Williston. If you have minerals or non-op working interests in these areas that you would like to sell, then please visit www.riverbendenergygroup.com for more information.
Hi there, it's Rachel Reese at R. Reese & Associates, your outhouse counsel. You may ask, what's an outhouse counsel? Well, it's a law firm that is focused on the day-to-day legal tasks that normally would be completed by your legal department. Our attorneys in Houston and DFW have spent their careers in both in-house positions and at large law firms and can provide your company with the efficient and responsive service you would expect from your own legal department for things like contracts, transactions, and title opinions at a fraction of the cost of what you're used to paying. So whether your company has no legal department or your legal department is a mighty team of one, we can help. Give us a call at 832-831-2289 or learn more at rreeselaw.com.
I get it now. So this is why, you know, you were saying timing could be really fruitful for you guys to come in and start a relationship with somebody because their credit capacity could be towards its end and almost fully drawn. And you're looking at an acquisition or something that's going to need more capacity. And so a fresh credit line then is needed, essentially.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Got it. You know, well, it's an off balance sheet transaction, right? So it doesn't show up in your numbers or your debt ratios or whatever it is. It's basically, you know, dealer A gives you X amount of credit. You put some trades on, and then, you know, DV gives you X amount of credit and you put some more trades on. Then they roll off, then you rebalance, you know. So that's kind of the, you know, and corporate treasurers and, you know, the CFOs have been kind of managing this for a long time, and they understand that it's kind of an art, not a science. But, you know, again, having more dealers and more optionality is always better.
Well, excellent. Well, thanks for walking through the mechanics on that a little bit. I'd love to shift gears a little bit just for everyone listening, the folks who like to follow the macro environment a little bit more and, you know, optimize their portfolios through hedging and other kinds of financial engineering. Let's just talk about the markets themselves. So natural gas, Gulf Coast LNG, 2025 is a big year. There's a lot of folks in the Haynesville that are trying to stockpile minerals assets right now, and they're banking on, you know, an uptick in pricing and that demand coming into the market, right? With these new facilities coming online. Gas was $8-9 at its peak last year. It's crashed, really volatile 12-month period. And then you got, you know, a lot of this stuff is baked into the futures prices, right? That these facilities coming online. So as someone who's actually, as a firm who's settling these trades and on the front lines and not just reading some Hart article about it, I'm curious to kind of hear your thoughts on that and the gas markets and what you're seeing and the dynamics at play.
Sure. I think the big message on the gas markets, right, is that the Ukrainian war put a nice floor under the long-term market, right? Much more than say pre-war, you know, in the, you know, 5-10 years ago, right? It was much more of a domestic market. You're subject to the sort of supply demand picture in the US primarily and weather. And the market was either upward sloping or backwardated, means downward sloping, the forward curve. And every year was different. You know, people watched hurricanes, people watched, you know, freeze offs in the Northeast. There's all this kind of, you know, volatility. And obviously the importance of US LNG to kind of save the bacon of Europe in 2022. And they've really gained and kept a lot of market share in that market, has put I'd call a decent long-term floor, probably not what everybody in the market would like to see, but, you know, you used to be worried about getting $3 for long-term gas, you know, if you're say a Haynesville producer or Northeast Marcellus producer, you know, sometimes you had that market, sometimes you didn't. Now, really the market, I think if you look down the curve is really, you know, it's just under $4, right? If you go down 25, 26, 27, you're kind of in that 390, 380 region for Henry Hub. It's been higher than that recently, but it's an upward sloping curve versus the spot. And it seems to be very stable, at least for the last year or so. So you've got a pretty nice $4-ish curve to hedge into if you're one of these, you know, large kind of Gulf Coast or Northeast gas players. You know, you talked, you know, it used to be $8, right? That was a pretty big dislocation. You had, you know, you had that sort of accelerated sort of, there was something like 30 ships coming from the Gulf Coast at some point, like trying to land in Europe, I think in 2022, late 22. So that sort of frenetic refilling of European storage is kind of a thing of the past, but, you know, you still got a strong source of demand in Europe, and you've got just your normal Asian demand, which is a little bit weather related, but is also very, very, you know, very consistent and now utilizing US LNG for a lot of their volumes. You know, I think you got a little bit of an issue with the Panama Canal right now. So it's slowing down any spot cargo leaving from the Gulf. I don't think is allowed to go through the Panama Canal. They're only allowing the companies that have long-term contracts.
Real quick, well, that's interesting on the Panama Canal thing, because the spot market has really exploded. And I think LNG, you know, US gas producers up to a certain, you know, dollar per MCF become the swing in LNG pricing globally. If, you know, gas starts to get more expensive, Australian can Qatargas, et cetera, become competitive with the U.S. natural gas producers? What is this about? You know, if you're not a long-term contract, you can't go through that. I just find that it's fascinating. Is that a new phenomenon? Or?
Yeah, there was a drought in Panama this year. And so, or I'd say last year. And so there's not enough, you know, the Panama Canal basically is a bunch of lakes that are fed by rain. There's, you know, through a rainforest. And if they don't get enough rain, every time a ship goes through the Panama Canal, they effectively lose water, right? Because they're refilling the locks. They bring it, you know, they basically bring a ship over the mountain, right? And so they pump up water to get the ship up to the central lake in the middle of Panama, and then they release that water as the ship goes down the other side in the Pacific. And so there's a finite amount of water that you know you need in that lake to keep the canal going at full speed. And they've gone down to like minimum numbers this day. But you know, I think end of this year, I'm not sure if there's been a little recovery recently, but it was a dire picture. So they basically said, you know, to anyone who just kind of showed up and wanted to go through the Panama Canal, you couldn't, or you had to have very long waits, or you just wouldn't be allowed to pass. So then you'd have to go around the bottom of South America, which adds 3 weeks or something to the voyage, right? So that sort of slowed down the flow of nat gas from the Gulf Coast to Asia through that route. And, you know, but you look at the netbacks. I mean, I think the main thing that producers, you know, keep their eyes on are what are the netbacks to the different markets, right? So as long as they're positive, right, which is basically the, you know, the cost of buying the gas, you know, in Louisiana or wherever it is, plus all the liquefaction costs and the terminaling costs. And then the shipping costs, as long as there's a positive spread to whatever whether it's a, you know, a European market or an Asian market like JKM or TTF, you know, JKM is kind of the Japanese market, TTF's the European market. As long as there's a positive spread, that gas is going to flow, right? And it's going to basically leave the Gulf Coast, and, you know, people are going to make money on that cargo. So it doesn't have as much of an effect on the Henry Hub price, I think, as people think, because, you know, there's only a fixed amount of capacity in terms of ships and terminaling and gasification. But it certainly can, if the, as you mentioned, like the spot market's gotten a lot bigger, and if there's a, you know, if there's a, you know, a sort of immediate demand for more cargoes, that can have an effect. But look, I think you look at the basis. I think the way you track this is basically what's the basis between the markets that are nearby the Gulf Coast, right? And those are things like Houston Ship Channel, Tennessee Zone Zero, like the basis Houston ships kind of from the south, like the Eagle Ford producers, you know, South Texas Gas, you know, Zone Zero's from the north, guys coming down from northeast, or, you know, from the Haynesville. That basis has been relatively stable in that kind of 20 to 50 cents range, less than Henry Hub. And it's, you know, it gets a little tighter the closer you get to spot. And then there's some weak periods like the summer next, you know, this summer is a little weaker than the winter, but it's a pretty stable basis point. And so it shows there's just kind of healthy demand from the Gulf Coast. Markets are functioning. It's pretty well balanced. And, you know, midstream is kind of keeping up with demand from the LNG shippers. And, you know, so which is, I think it's good for producers, right? They like to see stability in the markets. They can model it. They can drill into it. And, you know, it's a lot different from, say, like the Waha basis, which is what, you know, West Texas, which is much more all over the place, right? And so.
Yeah, well, that was my next question. So keeping on the theme of, you know, gas being exported out of the country, you know, Mexico is short gas and it's expensive to produce it there. My previous role at Energy Council ran Mexico. As it was privatized and opened up to private sector capital, and so I got to know the dynamics of you know, the Mexican kind of trading economy, and I think it's the Burgos Basin, which is the Eagle Ford in Mexico, and it's not the same, unfortunately, for Mexicans, but. Regardless, and I know ARM did some trading with Mexico, and I know of Grupo Clisa down there who has a trading business. I met with them several times. I know you guys did some stuff there. So you said it's a little more Wild West, a little all over the place. What leads to that volatility? I'm curious to kind of hear, again, how you just kind of answered the question on the Gulf Coast, take a stab, West Texas, over to you.
Sure. Yeah, we did a lot when I was at ARM in Mexico. It's a really interesting market. You know the Grupo Clisa guys well. The, you know, the the dynamic in Waha is basically you've got this enormous amount of associated gas, right? So most Permian producers are not making their decisions based on gas. They're making it on oil, right? And so the drilling, that gas is going to flow from producers irrespective of the price of gas, pretty much, by and large. Then you have two basically outlets for that, or I'd say three outlets for that gas, right? You've got the West Coast El Paso lines that goes out to Arizona and ultimately California. You've got a huge network of pipelines going to Mexico that are primarily controlled by CFE, which is the energy monopoly in Mexico. And then you've got an increasing number of pipes going to the Gulf Coast, like Whistler and Gulf Coast Express and things like that, which, you know, are subject to various different sort of stair steps of production of completion, right? The pipes will get full, then, you know, Energy Transfer or whoever it is will build, will basically sign up producers for another line. That'll take several years to get permitted, and sort of it kind of becomes gappy in terms of the capacity, the offtake capacity of the Gulf Coast. So you've got basically three outlets. You don't have any consumption in the area, practically speaking, right? So you are in Waha, you have an enormous amount of gas, right? I don't know the NAES number, but it's been growing. It's been growing rapidly every single year with Permian production. It's, you know, I don't know if it's north of 20 BCF, it's like 15 BCF or 20 BCF now. And so that has to go to either California through Arizona to Mexico or to the Gulf Coast. And so, and then you have weather, which can be very, very violent, both in West Texas and in Mexico, which affects the demand because all of that gas is primarily going to power supply into Mexico. And so you have a pretty volatile situation, right? If Mexico's is very, very hot and pulling all the gas it can, and California's hot and pulling all the gas it can, and all the pipelines to the Gulf Coast are working well, that basis tightens up, you know, and it gets to be, you know, 20, 30 cents under Henry Hub. If everything goes the opposite way, like it's cool in Mexico, it's cool in California, maybe there's a, you know, something goes down on a pipeline going to the Gulf Coast, no one wants to buy that gas, or there's way too much gas for that area. And the basis blows out and sometimes goes negative, right? So you can actually pay to get rid of your gas in the Permian sometimes. So it's a pretty crazy market. It typically trades kind of a dollar under Henry Hub and $1.50 to a dollar under Henry Hub. I think the infrastructure eventually gets, you know, a little bit more stable, but, you know, it's a wild market. So I think, you know, if you're a producer out there and you have a lot of gas, it's certainly worth hedging because it can really go against you.
Yeah. I mean, does it have to be major pipeline infrastructure to solve for some of the volatility? Can you know, Bitcoin mines and behind gate projects with solar and self-consumption projects make a dent, or it's just such a small fraction, you think, in your best estimates? Because you were thinking one of the challenges is that there's no local market for the scale of the gas being produced, right? So that would be the equivalent of like creating local demand, if you may, with a different model.
Yeah, I just think the numbers are so big, right, relative to the production. Like I'm sure a lot of your, you know, the companies you work with, right, are buying minerals or non-op under these huge, you know, under the Chevrons and the Exxons and the Pioneers and the, you know, the Encanas and everything are into, you know, out there that are putting these huge multi-year programs in place that, you know, the Delaware is really gassy, right? So you've just got this gas wedge coming online that, you know, you're not going to solve with local power production because you don't have that transmission lines out of there. I mean, making transmission lines is almost as hard as making a pipeline these days. And then, you know, so you really are relying on basically more robust export capacity out of the area. And it's pretty much impossible to build anything to California anymore. So you're really relying on additional pipeline going to the Gulf Coast or Mexican demand going up a little bit. Mexican demand is really just correlated to their GDP and their, you know, how quickly that economy grows versus, you know, they've sort of stopped building a lot of pipelines as well.
Okay. All right. So I guess kind of finishing, going around the horn on nat gas, MVP, I haven't looked it up recently, but it should be operational soon, or recently it became operational. Just what do you think the impacts are on MVP on pricing in the Northeast? Like, is it big enough to move the needle, or is it marginal.
You know, I haven't looked at that project as closely. I think it's necessary, but it's not going to have a massive impact on basis, unfortunately, right? I mean, I think it's really just about allowing some producers to drill some wells that they needed, you know, to ramp up their volumes. But I don't think it's going to have a huge, you know, basically global impact on like Northeast basis. But I think we've seen a couple other of the smaller pipelines that's come online, you know, kind of been a drop in the bucket, although they've been very important to us, you know, whatever producers right nearby that has basically had to suspend their drilling program because of lack of infrastructure. So, but, you know, unfortunately that resource is just constrained and looks to be constrained, you know, for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. But, so I guess the punchline is for a lot of smaller infrastructure projects, behind gate projects, it'll benefit a smaller group of people who are like directly offset. But at a macro level, it's not really moving the needle for basis on, you know, global trading markets.
I don't think. Yeah, we haven't seen it in, if you look kind of at those curves, I mean, those have been relatively stable, you know, kind of a Dom South or, you know, those major Northeast basis have been, you know, they kind of traded within their normal ranges for the last, you know, last year or so.
Okay. And then, you know, last kind of comment before we wrap up here, just your thoughts on crude. I think we've had a relatively bullish crude environment the last, I don't know, 18, 24 months. It's dipped down a little bit around, you know, kind of high 60s, 70s for a little bit. But for the most part, I think there's a lot of bulls in the market, and they feel like there's a lot of markers for the next few years supporting higher prices, whether that's inflationary pressures keeping up, you know, driving up commodity prices, or, you know, signals out of the Middle East, you know, wars, et cetera. Just what are kind of your thoughts on crude pricing and just all the dynamics that come into play?
Yeah, it's, you know, we were talking about that this morning with some other folks. You know, it's a market that's pretty well balanced right now. You've got a sort of consensus demand growth, you know, for the next two or three years that's, you know, 1 million to 2 million barrels a year of growth, which is pretty healthy, right? It's sort of normal type growth. I always view, we sort of view that as like a little bit, you know, a lot of those forecasts get sort of infected by the fever to move to renewables, right? And move to like, you know, that there's going to be a faster adoption of electric vehicles and that kind of thing. And that, so I think that's usually a little bit under the, you know, always you take the over on the demand growth versus the under versus like the EIA or DOE or whoever it is, right? Because they're always kind of hoping for lack of demand in those forecasts, right? And, you know, and they just can't really hold back, like, you know, India and Brazil and all these countries that are just, you know, continuing to grow pretty quickly. So I always take the over a little bit on the demand side. But the problem is I always take the over a little bit on the supply side as well, because the non-OPEC producers have shown themselves to be, you know, very healthy in their drilling programs and to continue to, you know, add, you know, improve technology. And, you know, you look at the major projects around the world, those things can really overperform in terms of production growth versus kind of the traditional view that, you know, we're sort of peak oil and going to, you know, and the decline curve is going to, you know, cause like a massive shortage, right? So you've got those two situations, which I think kind of balance each other out a little bit. And so you've got the forward curve is kind of that high 60s, mid to high 60s number. If you look down, you know, 25, 26, 27, spot is in that sort of 70 to 80 range. And so what you're left is a very stable market that is, you know, really can be changed materially by geopolitical events. And so, you know, I think people should, you know, people can get hedges down the curve in the 70s. And, you know, and there was times late last year, you know, you could get nice hedges kind of $75, right, down the curve, which is, I think, a great number. Now it's probably more like high 60s, but you know, in terms of swap price. But, you know, that's the market. It's pretty balanced. You know, there's not a lot. You know, I think one of the nice things is it's fairly, given the supply situation, given the demand growth and the just general lack of major recessions, I don't see us going back to like a $40, $50 market anytime soon, you know, which is good news. But, you know, waiting around for an $80 oil price, especially down the curve, you could be waiting a long time.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, no, volatility is a killer for deals. We're seeing mass upstream consolidation right now. And so that stable environment, not saying that is the main trigger, but it helps, right, for these things to get over the line. Well, Listen, well, really enjoyed coming on, I think, kind of talking about mechanics on the front end, and then just really appreciate you opening up your views and thoughts on the market dynamics with gas and oil. Before we wrap up the episode, just kind of circling back to DV. So if someone's interested in working with you guys, reaching out to you to explore more, what do those steps look like? Over to you to close it out.
Sure. You know, we're certainly fully open for business. You know, our team is primarily in New York, but as you mentioned, I get to Texas all the time. It's really just getting kind of starting an intro and getting to know you as a company, what you need, what the plan is, what the structure is, and then kind of going over obviously the basic requirements, which, we've kind of gone over earlier. But it's a pretty simple process. We just typically have, first meeting or intro call, and then gather a bunch of information, and then we can start working immediately, getting that all in place. And, but it's really just getting to know you as a company. I like the personal touch and getting to really understand the business plan, right? We're not one of, 14 people in the RBL group, or, we look at kind of building we're going to have a very sort of personal relationship. And so, introducing your team to some of my team and getting to know both sides, and then just getting the paperwork in place. But it's been, it's a pretty painless process from our end that I think, some of the folks that we've been trading with can attest.
Fantastic. Well, thanks again, Will, for coming on, and looking forward to seeing you at NAIP in a few weeks.
All right, Tim, really appreciate it. Really enjoyed the talk.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to this episode of the podcast. I hope you enjoyed. The Minerals and Royalties podcast is meant for informational purposes only. Tim Powell and the Minerals and Royalties Authority are not promoting any specific securities or investments, nor are they providing any type of investment advice. If you enjoyed the episode, then I encourage you to tune in more and also check out the Minerals and Royalties Authority YouTube channel. Thanks, and see you next time.